Ave and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast looking at the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and my guest today is Dr. Sonia Worster, a lecturer in classics at the University of Melbourne. This is episode XXIV, Cicero. A couple of months ago, I put out the call for some By Request episodes, and this is one of those requests. Shyam Chapaneri requested a podcast on Cicero, his oration, and philosophy. And now, here's Dr. Sonia Worster.
Cicero was born in a town called Apernum, which is modern Aperno in Italy, and he was born in 106 BCE on the 3rd of January. We know that his family was, he was a member of the local elite in Apernum, and he was what we call an equestrian. So when we talk about an equestrian rank in Rome, what that means is not the top of the top, that's the senatorial class, but they're still land-owning elite. So he came from a well-off family in Apernum who had political profile there.
What sort of role would he have been groomed for in his life then?
Definitely one for politics. I guess at this point in the late Republic, people are trying to get into the Senate because it helps raise the profile of your family. Whether or not he was groomed from a young age to try and enter the Roman Senate, we don't know, but he was certainly groomed for political life.
Do we know much about his young life then?
Not very much, no. He doesn't really tend to talk about that. So we can kind of hypothesize based on what we know about other people of his class, and we certainly can guess about the sort of education he would have received.
So he would have been schooled in stuff like public speaking and the laws.
Yep. That's right. So it wasn't a fixed and formal education system in ancient Rome, but they did tend to follow a certain path of learning how to read and then write. Once you move beyond that, you'd learn philosophy and oratory. Those were kind of the so-called higher stages of education. Practice oratory in public for a while, and it was actually making him sick because he'd get so stressed and he'd have to project his voice and it would make him sick. So he went to Greece to learn from Greek rhetors who were really experienced in public speaking, and they taught him how to sort of use his diaphragm and speak properly. And when he came back, that's when he kind of must have started to take on this aura of being an amazing orator.
So he clearly had a lot of opportunity in his early life to
Absolutely.
Pursue this sort of career as well. I take it that he must have shown a lot of promise at this stage to even get that opportunity.
Yes. I mean, he does come from a social class where it was the norm for someone of an equestrian rank from a family like his with power and wealth to have access to a very high level of education. But there's no doubt about it. I think Cicero was particularly talented. His future career tells us that. He was what we call a novo homo, so a new man. So that means that he was the first person in his family to join the Roman Senate. And not only that, he was also the first person in his family to become consul. And that is really rare. So it's not unusual for equestrians to join the Roman Senate, but usually it takes a generation or two for them to be then elected consul. So for someone to do it in their own lifetime, become a senator and a consul, is phenomenal. The only other sort of two people that I can think of off the top of my head who did this were Marius and Cato the Elder. He obviously was very good at what he did.
So Cicero started his career as a lawyer and then he progressed quite quickly to a quaestor. So can you track his career a little bit? He was early posted in Sicily, and the first major case that we've got him coming across, all that we know about that's really famous, is that where he prosecuted a man named Verres. So can you tell me about the context of that a bit?
Sure. So he'd already had his kind of apprenticeship. It's called a Tyrocinium Fori, which is just that, an apprenticeship in the forum almost. And that's really how you gain political power in Rome, by either prosecuting people or defending people. You kind of grow your allegiances that way, and then people will vote for you because you've either defended them or prosecuted someone that they wanted you to prosecute. And so what Cicero does is he normally actually is a defender. Being a defender is a much safer strategy. So that's why the Verres case is really significant.
So in this case, he was prosecuting.
Because he was prosecuting.
What was the benefit to him to prosecute this one?
Sure.
Was it that high profile? Was it?
It was a high profile. That's right. And he also felt like he wanted to do it for personal reasons because of his time in Sicily. A lot of people whom he'd known in Sicily came to ask him to take on the case. But it's really interesting, his strategy in running the case, because even though he's a prosecutor, he acts like he's the defender of Sicily. So he is prosecuting, but he's trying to skew the case to seem more like he's the defender. The trial actually never ended because Verres ran away.
So what did he do?
Verres? Yeah. What didn't he do, I think, is what Cicero wants us to think. So he basically was, I think, taking public funds, taking artwork off local Sicilians. He was very corrupt, right, basically. And look, it was very common for Roman governors to use their posting in a province to make themselves wealthy. But this went far and beyond the normal behaviour for a governor.
Yeah, yeah, definitely if it's gone to a case like this. So what was Cicero's strategy in this then?
So his strategy was really to just make Verres look as criminal as possible. So when you read his case against Verres, he really just represents him as a complete degenerate, as completely morally bankrupt. Verres really brought Sicily to its knees. Everyone was scared of him. And he builds the case so that he kind of ends with this situation where Verres seems to have flogged a Roman citizen in public, which is a no-no. It's a very cleverly put together case because he starts with kind of the small stuff.
Really dragged out the drama in it.
Really dragged out the drama. Now, of course, when we talk about this case, as I said, it didn't finish ever because Verres ran off. So what we have of against Verres is Cicero's later account. So that's why we have the whole case, even though he actually didn't end up finished prosecuting Verres.
So what benefit did this case have for Cicero?
Well, because he ended up being successful indirectly, you get more supporters that way. And if you are a good prosecutor, then people will ask you to defend them. And once you defend them, then they owe you something because you weren't actually allowed to pay a Roman orator like Cicero for their services. So instead of payment, they would receive political support. You can actually track the fact that he did the case against Verres in 70. Following year, he took on a new role on the Cursus Honorum. That's kind of like the list of jobs that you get to make your way up to consul.
Right.
And you had
right.
to do each one to get to consul, and there were minimum ages for doing them at.
And at every rank, he was joining it at the minimum age that he could, wasn't he?
He was, except for quaestor.
Yeah.
But that's because he was a new man and people didn't really, I think, know him that well. But after quaestor, you're exactly right. He gets it at the minimum age, which is extremely rare, not just for someone who comes from an old, established member of the nobilis. So that's the nobs. Yes, exactly right. But for someone who's a new man to do that, he must have been very good.
Yeah. So while he's progressing through the political ranks, what sort of personal life does he have? What do we know about his family?
So he was married to a woman called Terentia, and he had a daughter, Tullia, and he also had a son. But we know a lot more about his relationship with Tullia because she actually dies, because he's such a prolific writer and he wrote lots of letters. We have a series of quite personal letters where he talks about his grief over his daughter's death, and they're quite moving and very, very personal. And when his daughter dies, he's desperate to start some shrine to her. And so he's going around Rome asking people if he can buy their houses and gardens from them. And he doesn't end up, I think, doing anything about this, but that's just kind of his expression of grief. And it's kind of unusual because when you read most Roman sources, you know, they're very historical or they're to do with people's public lives. To have this very personal discussion of his feelings about his daughter's death is really moving.
Would that be because he was writing to a close friend of his, wasn't he?
Yes.
Atticus?
Atticus is usually the person.
Yeah.
So we have letters from Cicero to Atticus, Cicero to other family members, and Cicero to Brutus. They vary the letters. So some of them are very formal and almost legal in tone. Others are very, very personal. There's a great variety of them. They're very interesting, the letters.
Mm. And I think Cicero's son, Marcus, deserves a mention because otherwise he'd never be mentioned historically. And he seems to be the typical rich boy who could never come out of his father's shadow. He spends his entire life being put in great positions and letting everybody down in the process, it seems.
I think it would be very hard to compete with Cicero. I don't think I'd want Cicero as my father.
They're very big shoes to fill.
They are.
So Cicero rose through the ranks and became consul in 63 BC. Mm-hmm. And in that year, he defeated the Catiline conspiracy.
Yes.
So can you tell me about that? Because that has a huge impact on his...
has a massive career impact on the rest of his life. Yeah. So there was this figure called Lucius Sergius Catilina, or Catiline as we call him in English. And he's rumoured, and I say rumoured because we obviously do not have his perspective on any of this. We've only really got hostile sources that talk about Catiline, and he's rumoured to have attempted to overthrow the Republic and to lessen the power of the Senate.
He was going to assassinate Cicero as well, wasn't he?
That's the rumour, yeah.
That rumour is in Cicero's interest?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. All right. He basically uses his skill as an orator to convince them.
Absolutely, he does.
Quite laboriously, I imagine.
Yes, you're right. He absolutely wins because he's a very, very good speaker.
And Catiline doesn't stick around to defend himself so much.
He does a little bit, but his argument is pretty average argument. He says to the Senate, "I don't know why you're supporting Cicero. I'm a member of an old family. You should be supporting me, not this new guy." Cicero is far superior in his ability to convince the Senate to side with him against Catiline.
I mean, obviously he's got a personal stake in this, but why is Cicero so against this?
He's very conservative. So as is often the case with someone who's a new man in Rome, they tend to be politically conservative. And the way that Cicero got to power was actually by cultivating alliances with old Roman families who don't want the power of the Senate to change. And so you have a kind of tension in the Roman elite between people who want to draw more on the power of the people. So that's people like Caesar, for example, is often said to cultivate relationships with the people in order to gain political power. Cicero didn't do that at all. He went the opposite avenue. And so his problem with Catiline is Catiline wants to reform the Senate, basically, and to lessen the power of the Senate, which is therefore to lessen the power of Rome's old families. They're basically on different political sides.
So Cicero wins this debate. How are the conspirators punished?
So what he does is he manages to intercept some letters that they've written. He reads those letters by the five conspirators to the Senate. So then they're confronted with direct evidence of the conspiracy itself. And then it's impossible to deny that something's going on. And what he does is there's something called the technical Latin term is a senatus consultum ultimum, is something that the Senate can bring into play in times of emergency. So in this case, Cicero argues that there is a major threat to the state, which constitutes an emergency. And that means it indemnifies someone like Cicero, for example, who's consul, from any decisions they make whilst consul. Later on, he argues, it was okay for me to execute these Roman citizens without a trial because I had senatus consultum ultimum. The argument doesn't stick, unfortunately. Later on, a figure called Publius Clodius Pulcher. Pulcher means beautiful in Latin. So Publius Clodius Pulcher brings a law into the Roman Senate that says anyone who's executed a Roman citizen without a trial has to go into exile as a result of his action in prosecuting the Catiline conspirators.
Right. So he wins that debate, but it ultimately comes back to bite him.
Really bites him in the...
But I guess it says something about him that he's able to convince the Senate. Roman citizens weren't executed back then,
no,
were
they? Weren't. No, and they were supposed to not be subject to any corporal punishment or capital punishment. So it's a really big deal. His oratorical skills are that good that he managed to convince the Senate of the threat of the Catiline conspirators.
So Cicero doesn't spend long in exile and he returns by popular demand, really, a year later.
Yeah.
So we now reach the point of the Roman Empire where it's the rise of Julius Caesar and the crumbling of the Senate. So how does he respond?
He's always been more on Pompey's than Caesar's side, but he sort of has a love-hate thing with Caesar. He's sort of drawn to Caesar's magnetic personality, but he also doesn't really like Caesar's politics, so to speak. But over time, I think he feels like everything's just falling apart. And so he withdraws much more into his philosophy. And what he does is instead of taking on the political system head on, he writes philosophical treatises that critique the political system.
He was originally offered to be the fourth member of the triumvirate, which wouldn't be a triumvirate at that point.
Yeah.
But he was initially offered that role, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And because he's a staunch Republican, he doesn't agree with that sort of governing system. He would prefer a much more traditional Roman Senate. It sounds defeatist on Cicero's part that he withdrew to philosophy, but he genuinely saw that as a productive way to critique the system.
So shall we talk a bit about his philosophy now?
Yeah, of course. As a philosopher, you'll often read that Cicero is a Stoic, which is strictly speaking not true. He was what we call an academic skeptic. An academic skeptic, it derives from Plato's philosophy, and it means that they don't think that the best system has yet been worked out for philosophy. So he has leanings towards Stoicism because he feels at this point in time, Stoicism is offering the best answers, but it's not necessarily the complete system, so to speak. And that's why he actually writes in that dialogue format. A lot of his philosophical works are a dialogue. He's really following in Plato's footsteps there. And the advantage to a dialogue format when you're not sure about your views is it enables you to question lots of different philosophical schools. And that's why he's such an important source for philosophy, because he records Epicurean views, Stoic views, academic views, and philosophical views as well.
I very much see Cicero as a symbol of the old Rome, the old Republic. So by that extension, was his death inevitable because he would always remind people of what Rome was?
I don't know if it was inevitable, but it certainly seems that because he was willing to kind of put his views out there, he was always going to be a threat to any social change that people were trying to enact. And it's hard to say what would have happened with Octavian and Cicero, but obviously with Antony, he was just so vocally opposed to Antony that that really caused some problems for him.
I feel that Antony would have had a list which said, right, what do I need to do today? Okay, I still need to kill Cicero.
Yeah.
And that's always going to be on Antony's list.
Yes, that's right. So if he maybe had been able to outlive Antony, so to speak, it would have been interesting to see how he would have reacted to some of the changes that Octavian or Augustus brings in later on.
So how does he die then?
Well, Antony puts Cicero on a prescription list and sends a soldier to kill him. And when the soldier arrives, Cicero says to him, "There is nothing proper about what you're doing, soldier, but do try to kill me properly."
So he's very resigned to his fate then.
Yes. Yes, that's right. And that's kind of that influence of Greek philosophy, particularly Hellenistic philosophy, where it's about emotional self-control. So I think that that story kind of arises out of Cicero's supreme self-control and that kind of very extreme situation.
So Cicero had a lot of, can I say, masks, a lot of guises in his life. So what would he think of himself as? Would he think of himself as a philosopher, an orator, a politician?
I think he would have thought of himself as orator, which in Rome means to be a politician, first and foremost. But philosophy was very important to him, but he thought philosophy should be used in the service of politics. So I guess he would have thought of himself as a weird hybrid, like a philosopher-politician.
I'm a politician, but I'm a freelance philosopher.
Yeah, that's right. Most elite Romans would have studied philosophy to some extent. Cicero obviously took that to a whole other level because he was the first Roman to attempt to write Greek philosophy in Latin, which was very important because up until that point, everyone thought only Greek had the vocabulary to express philosophical concepts, and Cicero destabilizes that view.
In the modern context, though, what do we think Cicero was? How do we define him?
I think people think of him as a statesman, and then secondly, as a philosopher.
So if people want to do a bit of reading up on Cicero or reading of his works, what would you recommend? What is out there that we have? Quite a lot.
We have lots of Cicero's work.
Which is good.
People will often refer to the late Republic as the Ciceronian age.
Right.
Because he skews our perception so much of this period. I think that starting with his letters is not a bad approach because his letters contain some of his philosophical ideas. They contain a lot of his political views, but they're also slightly personalized. So you probably get a more well-rounded image. Once you've sort of got a picture of Cicero, you can read his speeches. He's very catty usually in his speeches. He's a lot of fun to read in that respect. I mean, I know when I was in high school, I used to think Cicero was really boring, and I used to think his speeches were really boring. But the more you read them, the more you realize just how clever he was at really getting to the heart of an issue and then formulating a strategy in his speech that was so consistent and built up. There's a reason why he won as much as he did, was as successful as he was, because his speeches are phenomenal to read.
That's Dr. Sonia Worster, a lecturer in classics at the University of Melbourne. And that's it today for The Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can find it on iTunes. please leave a review there and tell your friends about it. And I've got a Patreon campaign to set up a new podcast looking at places in Rome, so please think about supporting it and go to patreon.com/mattsmith. There'll be links to it as well on our Facebook page, and trust me, I'll be tweeting about it as well. You can follow me on Twitter, I'm at nightlightguy, and you can follow Sonia, she's at sonnybonnie, at SonnyBonnie. Tune into the next episode of Emperors of Rome, in which I will be joined again by Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and we'll be looking at the life of Livia. Until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.